This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Welcome to 2017. As the new year begins, you may be planning to make some changes. And as a nation, we certainly seem to be in a state of flux, both socially and politically. So how do we make sure we actually follow through on things like good old New Year's resolutions? And how do we prepare ourselves to handle changes that are beyond our control? The science of psychology and even neurobiology has plenty to say on those topics, and today we have three perspectives for you. Later this hour, psychologist Susan David shares her method for embracing change, and mindfulness expert Jon Kabat-Zinn talks about being so relaxed you're okay with stress. First, though, we turn to Timothy Wilson. He's Cheryl J. Aston Professor of Psychology at the University of Virginia, and he's the author of three books, most recently Redirect: The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. He joins me now by phone. Tim, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning, Heather.
So a lot of your new book focuses on the stories we tell ourselves. I mean, what do you mean by that phrase?
Well, I think we all develop narratives about who we are and why we do what we do. And by that, I mean everything from the big questions, what our purpose is in life, down to little things such as why we just ate the whole pint of ice cream when we're on a diet, or why did that person just smile at me? You know, we're interpreters of ourselves.
How do those stories, how does that internal monologue end up affecting what we do and how successful we are at what we set out to do?
Well, they're hugely important for our well-being. I mean, we can have, really good stories about ourselves that give us confidence and steer us towards what we want to get out of life. Or sometimes those stories go wrong. They can be pessimistic and make us give up and not try as hard as we could to succeed.
So how would we go about changing those stories? I mean, that seems like an almost unconscious process that's going on inside our heads.
Well, yes, but this is the really cool thing about a lot of research in my field, social psychology, that I think we often tend to view these stories as set in stone. There's something maybe we developed in childhood and they're really hard to change. And, you know, granted, sometimes they are, but the exciting research shows that a little bit of redirection can go a long way to helping us change our stories. And there are a couple ways to do it. One is, there's an old adage that often changing our behavior first leads to changes in our views of ourselves. This idea dates back to Aristotle, who said, we become courageous by performing acts of courage. So, if our goal is to, go on a diet as a New Year's resolution or become a better person, starting small, just changing our behavior in a little way can get the ball rolling.
That seems kind of circular, though, if you're saying that our stories determine our success, but actually taking the action, trying to be successful at it, is what will change the story. I mean, how do we get into this loop to begin with?
Fair enough, but I think we can get stuck in these cycles where, we have a negative view and we don't really try to change it and it reinforces itself. I'm a college professor. I see students get stuck in this kind of self-defeating story about themselves that they're not good at math or what have you, and that leads them not to try. But, to bump us out of that and to begin the story revision process, I do think that changing our behavior is a good place to start. There are other ways, too. There's some really cool writing exercises people can do to get the ball rolling as well.
Is this something that requires, do you think, professional assistance, or is it something that people can do on their own at home?
Oh, definitely on their own. Now, at the same time, I'm a big believer in psychotherapy for people who need it, that people who are really distressed, psychotherapy works. But I kind of view it as, whether our car needs a little tune-up or a major engine overhaul. Sometimes our stories just need a little tweaking, a little tune-up, and those are definitely things we can work on ourselves.
Can you give us some examples of where this idea of story editing has proven successful? What are the kinds of stories that are potentially self-defeating, and how do you specifically edit those to make them promote more successful behavior?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of research where researchers try to change other people's stories in beneficial ways. And one of my favorite examples is some studies done with parents who are at risk for child abuse. And there's lots of programs out there where they are assigned home visitors to help them learn parenting skills, and they're good as far as they go. But this particular study added a little story editing element to this, where one thing about parents who are at risk for child abuse is they often blame their kids for acting out. If a baby fusses too much, they often will say, you know, their interpretation or their story about that is, oh, that baby's mad at me or out to get me, something, you know, kind of crazy like that. And in the study, the home visitors just tried to get them to change that interpretation, that story. They, using a kind of Socratic method, when their child would act up, they'd ask the parent why they thought that was, and often the parents would give that pejorative, negative interpretation. And the home visitor would just sort of gently say, well, can you think of another reason why that might be, or what's another explanation? And then reinforce ones that didn't blame the child and were things that the parent could change easily, like they didn't burp their baby enough, something like that. And as you know, as simple as that sounds, it reduced child abuse in these families to near zero from rates that were pretty high in control groups. So, you know, it's a good example where just a little edit that can then reinforce itself can have big benefits.
It sounds like that question that in this case, the home visitors were posing to another person, but perhaps we could all try to pose to ourselves more often is maybe there's another way. Is there another way to look at this situation and to look at myself and my own behavior? Maybe that could actually get people into figuring out what their stories are that they're telling themselves and how they might want to change them.
Well, definitely. And you know, as I mentioned, there are some neat writing exercises that can help people do that. And, you know, one of my favorites is to just take out a piece of paper and think of something about ourselves that we're feeling bad about or something that happened to us we're unhappy about and write about it in the third person as if someone else were looking at us. And particularly trying to answer the question of why did this happen? Why did I respond the way I did to my boss or whatever it was? And distancing ourselves in that way, looking at it through the eyes of another person, can trigger this kind of story editing where we see new meaning in it, come up with a new interpretation that might make us feel better.
With regard to something a lot of people are doing right now, making New Year's resolutions, what kinds of stories might we want to start telling ourselves as we set out to make whatever change in our daily lives we're kind of trying to make this year?
Well, I guess my advice would be, first of all, don't start too big. I mean, don't make a resolution that says, you know, I'm going to lose 40 pounds or I'm going to, you know, whatever. That starts small with achievable goals. You know, one of my vices is sweets. And, you know, if I tell myself, okay, I'm not going to eat chocolate for a month, I know I'm not going to succeed at that.
But you and me both.
Yeah, you know, I can go tomorrow without eating chocolate. And particularly if we say to ourselves how we're going to do it. So instead of just declaring this resolution, really thinking about how we're going to get from A to B. So, okay, you know, maybe I'll hide my Belgian chocolate back in the closet or something, you know, or I'll buy some nice fruit to eat instead. You know, really having a specific plan as to how to accomplish it. And, you know, as far as the stories go, a little success does feed back into our story to some extent. Yes, I am the kind of person who can do this if I can get that little success.
Your prior book was about something called the adaptive unconscious. What is that, and how do these stories affect that aspect of our minds?
Well, you kind of mentioned it earlier, Heather, that these stories aren't entirely conscious. You know, I don't want to give the impression that you know we go around every day and okay, what's my story today? I do think they're more implicit. They're kind of ways we've come to view ourselves, and that's why you know it does take more than just you know, consciously rewriting these stories. It takes something to kickstart the unconscious, and I think these writing exercises can do that. You know, writing is something that I think can help stimulate our unconscious as we do it. As any writer knows, you're often digging deeply as you write. And so, the goal is to change this more unconscious way of viewing the world that is tricky, but can be done.
Are there ways that this idea of story editing could be used not only to address issues of individual personal change, but perhaps more collective change, family, community, even broader social change?
Well, there's some really neat applications of it in education, where researchers are using it to change students' views of themselves, and which leads to better academic performance. And you know, one example of that is Carol Dweck's work on mindsets, where the idea is to convince students that intelligence is something that isn't fixed. It's not something you're born with. It's something we develop. It's like a muscle that grows with exercise. And she and her team have come up with some really ambitious interventions that any school can adopt. And by convincing kids that they should change their mindset, it leads to better performance in school. And that's just one example of an educational applications that are ongoing.
I guess I was thinking even more broadly about kind of social change, changing our collective perspective about how we view problems within society or issues that we would like to address.
Well, it might be possible. I think, one way of viewing our current, divisiveness in this country, I think, is a battle of stories. You know, who's going to win the narrative of who we are as a nation and where we should be going? And I think in a way that's the goal of politicians and intellectuals is to implant their narrative, and whether that will succeed, one side will win, I doubt, but that's what we're fighting about.
Is there any way that the process of story editing could actually backfire? Could we tell ourselves delusionally positive stories that would actually hurt us? I mean, I guess I'm extrapolating backward from the idea of revisionist history at a social level, but could we be doing that to ourselves and actually kind of shooting ourselves in the foot somehow?
Well, I guess there's some risk of that, but there's actually a big debate in my field about this. One side says that a little bit of positive illusions about ourselves is actually a good thing. It gives us confidence, as long as we're not distorting reality to the extreme. But having a view that we're maybe even a little more talented than we really are, or able to accomplish things, it actually gets us out of bed in the morning and motivates us. And I kind of agree with that. It obviously can be taken too far, and we don't want people to be delusional, and we don't want everyone to be convinced that they're going to win The Voice or become the president, because not everyone will. But on the other hand, I do think, giving ourselves a little confidence to try is a good thing. And one other thing I'll say, as I mentioned before, for people who are really severely distressed, so people who are suffering from depression, then psychotherapy is the ticket. And I think, these kinds of exercises I'm talking about, again, they're more for tune-ups than major engine overhauls.
Well, I think a lot of us are in the tune-up mode right now as we start the new year. Okay. Timothy Wilson of the University of Virginia, author of Redirect, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. Tim, thank you so much and Happy New Year.
Same to you, Heather. Thanks for having me on.
Up next, the science of how to get unstuck and embrace change with psychologist Susan David. That's coming up when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about how the brain handles change, the kind you might try to make with a New Year's resolution, and also the kind that you don't get a choice about. My next guest is Susan David. She's a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. She's co-founder and co-director of the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital, and she's CEO of Evidence-Based Psychology, a consulting firm. She's also the author of the new book, Emotional Agility: Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Susan David, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for inviting me.
What is emotional agility?
So emotional agility is the ability to be with our thoughts, our emotions, and the stories that we tell ourselves in ways that still allow us to be effective in the world. What's fascinating is that while so much of what comes to us is about how to be happier and how to be more disciplined, what we know as human beings is how we deal with our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories drives everything. And emotional agility is that skill set, how to be effective with what's inside of us.
So that's the first part of your book title. The second part, get unstuck. You also use the word sometimes being hooked by your emotions. What do those phrases mean?
So often what we land up doing in our lives is we allow our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories to dominate our actions. For example, someone might be sitting in a meeting and they might say, I'm being undermined, so I may as well just keep quiet. Or my spouse is starting in on the finances again, I'm just going to leave the room. Or even in less overt ways, we might come home from work and be really stressed. And so we're on our cell phones and not being present as a parent. So the idea of being hooked is really being in a state where our inner psychology, our thoughts, our emotions, the stories that we tell ourselves drive us in ways that are disconnected with our values and disconnected with how we really want to be in the world.
You have boiled down your process for trying to get unstuck and become more emotionally agile to a four-step process. And the first step is simply recognizing those patterns, recognizing where and how you are stuck. But I wonder how you actually go about doing that, how you step outside yourself enough to start to recognize those.
So this is a critical aspect. And in emotional agility, I talk about this as being the idea of showing up. We live in a culture that tells us that we need to be happy all the time and that we need to be goal-directed and focus on the project and, you know, achieve all the things that we're trying to achieve. And yet, so often in our day-to-day lives, we experience sadness, we experience frustration, we experience fear or anxiety about things. And so the idea of showing up is effectively that we only get to be good with ourselves and learn from ourselves and even learn from what is most difficult for ourselves by listening in to that dialogue. So really what showing up is this idea that, yes, while we're told to be happy all the time, that these emotions are there for a reason. They've helped us for millions of years to survive, and that so often beneath our difficulties are signs to things that we care about and our values. So there are a couple of ideas beneath the showing up. The first is ending any struggle that you have in yourself by dropping the rope. And what I mean by that is if you're unhappy in your job, not to say, well, at least I've got a job, you know, and ignore that emotion, but to rather face into it in a way that is compassionate. Other strategies that I talk about that are very, very practical are, for example, we know that there is a world of difference between being stressed versus frustrated, stressed versus anxious, stressed versus I thought my life would be very different. And yet what we know is that so often people will use a word like stress to define everything. And when we become more nuanced, when we label our emotions more effectively, we know that those individuals are firstly psychologically healthier and happier. Secondly, they are able to actually achieve their goals better. That this idea of labeling in a more nuanced way what it is that we're feeling starts to activate what is called the readiness potential in our brains, allows us to start setting goals and making real changes. So I talk about some very practical ways that we can start becoming more effective with our emotions, ways that aren't taught in school or in business school, but that are fundamental to our effectiveness and our success in life.
How does one go about learning these new vocabularies and even just practicing the habit of labeling your emotions? How do you actually make those new habits stick?
So very importantly, there's some things that are important up front. One of them, for example, is recognizing, just even starting to recognize when you are struggling with an emotion. So when you say to yourself, I shouldn't be sad, I shouldn't be anxious. So a very first important aspect is to really enter into a space with ourselves that just is honest and feels connected and feels compassionate. Other strategies that are just very practical and that do enable us to develop very functional habits around this are, for example, noticing your emotion for what it is. So when you are sitting in a meeting and you're saying, I'm being undermined, or I am anxious and I am going to stuff up that presentation, simply saying, I'm noticing the thought that I'm being undermined, or I'm noticing the feeling of anxiety. So literally just entering this very short recognition of what the thing is. It's an emotion. It's a thought. What that starts to do is it starts to create space between us and our emotions. You know, this very lovely Viktor Frankl quotation. Viktor Frankl, of course, survived the Nazi death camps. And what he writes is this idea that between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose, and it's in that choice that comes our growth and freedom. Now, so often when we're hooked, what we do is we feel upset, so we walk out the room, or we act in very patterned ways. And a first really important part of creating the space is being able to move into noticing those emotions for what they are, starting to label them, starting to recognize that this is a thought. Who's in charge here, the thinker or the thought? And then I also talk about in the book some very, very important other aspects. So, for example, having front of mind what your values are. You know, what's important to me in work is being a contributor. What's important to me in a relationship is a sense of mutual connection and caring. We know that these values start to help us to create real change in our lives.
You say it's not enough to just label an emotion, but you have to then accept it. How is that different than what I think a lot of us have been taught our whole lives to do, which is control your emotions?
It's completely different. We grow up very often in our households and our families where, wittingly or not, often we get these messages that, you know, when you're angry, go to your room and come out when you've got a smile on your face. Or a parent, and I've done it, you know, we all with the best of intentions, our child comes home from school and says, you know, I'm unhappy, mommy, because no one would play with me. And so we often want to jump in and save our children. You know, I'll make a play date with the mean girl, or I'll speak to the parent and we'll sort this out. So what we start to learn in our lives is fundamentally this idea that, number one, emotions are bad, and number two, that they need to be controlled. They need to be pushed aside, and instead we should be happy. Now, what's really interesting with this is it doesn't work. What we know from the psychological research is that when we start to try to control our emotions, we push them aside, what we know is that those emotions come back. So, for example, if you ask people to not think about the fact that they're really unhappy or angry with someone and to just not say anything at the Thanksgiving dinner table or at a family gathering, we know that the person who tries to push those emotions aside will be likely to say the very thing that he or she doesn't want to say. We know that when we try not to think of chocolate cake because we're on a diet, we dream of chocolate cake. So, you know, what's really interesting is we grow up in a world that tells us that we should be controlling these emotions, and that somehow by controlling emotions and thinking happy, that we'll become happy. But actually what the research shows is the opposite, that when we instead embrace the emotions, label the emotions, it doesn't mean that those emotions need to become directions. They're data, not directions. But when we can label them, when we can be with them, when we can accept them, then we are able to use our resources instead of trying to control, we're able to use our resources instead in trying to make change.
Well, this is a time of year when a lot of people are thinking about making changes, and you mentioned the diet and the chocolate cake. Do you make New Year's resolutions?
I make some resolutions, but the resolutions are less about very, you know, strict rules. And I far more try to think about, and this is something that I talk about in emotional agility, are what are some small changes that I want to make that are values congruent? And very important there is the values congruent, because what is clear in looking at habit change is that unless we are really aligned with why it is inside of us that we want to make a change, that it's unlikely for those changes to be successful.
Why would we, you know, say we want to make a change that you're saying we don't really want to make?
Yes, so a very, very interesting question. But of course, we all do this. So often in our lives, we set what we call have-to goals. So a have-to goal is a goal that we might even peg ourselves towards. You know, I have to get a promotion. I have to lose weight. I have to do these things. And a have-to goal is a goal that is usually driven by a sense of obligation. I need to lose weight because my doctor's at me. I need to lose weight because my wife is complaining about my beer belly. A have-to goal is driven by a sense of obligation or a sense of shame. A want-to goal, on the other hand, is driven by really an intrinsic, deeply felt value. I want to lose weight because I want to see my children grow up, and that's really critically important to me. Now, so often in our lives, we set have-to goals. Everyone else is doing something, so we feel like we have to do it. What's really interesting is that we start to see very important differences in how people can achieve these goals based on whether the goal is a have-to goal or want-to goal. So if you don't mind me going back to the chocolate cake.
Of course not. It's one of my favorite things in life, so let's talk about it.
Okay, so imagine you open a refrigerator and there is a piece of chocolate cake inside that refrigerator. Someone, knowing you were on diet, still went and bought the chocolate cake. So you open the refrigerator and you've got a have-to goal. What we know is that the have-to goal actually ramps up your temptation. So you want the very thing that you cannot have. Have-to goals develop in us a sense of resentment. Okay, and we all do this in different ways, like I have to be on dad duty, or I have to pick up my kids, or I have to go to people for, you know, a particular lunch. We all wrap ourselves up in have-to goals. Now, have-to goals ramp up temptation, create a greater sense of resentment. And what's really fascinating is what we know is that when you open that refrigerator, your brain processes taste attributes 195 milliseconds sooner than you even know you are making a decision. So, you know this whole thing about willpower, do I have willpower, don't have willpower? Willpower doesn't even actually come into the picture. Your brain knows whether you are eating the chocolate cake or not before you've even, you know, aware of the fact that you need to start exerting willpower.
That seems completely depressing and self-defeating.
So what's fascinating is a have-to goal actually makes us want the very thing that we've imposed that we can't have. Now, take instead a want-to goal. A want-to goal ramps down temptation. We open the refrigerator and, yes, we see the chocolate cake, but it's not the only thing we see. We see everything else. Want-to goals ramp down temptation and lead us to be able to make much more sustainable change. So these different types of goals actually quite literally alter the physics of willpower and alter the ability to make habit change in a long-term way.
You've mentioned a couple of times the psychological research that shows what does and doesn't work. Do we have any understanding of the underlying neurobiology of why these different things happen, why some things work and others don't?
We're starting to understand. So we're starting to understand, for example, that when people start to set goals, that there is an aspect of our of what we do, which is called the readiness potential. So there's this readiness potential in our brains, which is that process that starts saying, right, I've got to do A, B, C. This is what I've actually got to do to achieve these goals. What we know is that when we have a want-to goal, that is something developed from a sense of values and a truly felt desire within us, that that readiness potential is more likely to get activated. So it starts to actually make real change. We know, for example, related to what we spoke about earlier, that when instead of people saying, you know, I'm unhappy, but I'm just not going to think about it, instead when they go to their feelings, they name their feelings, that again, what that does is it starts to help them to face up in an honest way to what is going on in their lives, and again, help them to set effective goals. So there are different aspects of this, but yeah, we're starting to understand, for example, one thing that very often you will read in habit change is people will say, oh, if you want to lose weight, just imagine yourself being thin. You know, imagine yourself having completed the marathon. Now, what's really interesting is the research shows that from the neurobiological perspective, that when you imagine yourself having successfully lost weight or completed the marathon, it almost tricks your brain into believing that it's already done the work. So these positive affirmations in of themselves don't work. What does work is when you have a positive affirmation or a positive thought of yourself having completed the goal. But then what you do is what's called mental contrasting. You start saying, what might go wrong? What might not work here? What are the obstacles that I'm going to face? And we know that those two things in combination both activate our motivation, but also start to engage the part of our brain, which is around the planning, the problem solving, and the strategizing in ways that are really important to habit change.
So for everybody setting New Year's resolutions, make sure you really want that change. Envision it happening, but also plan for all the roadblocks and be realistic about what it's going to take to get there.
Absolutely.
That's psychologist Susan David. She's author of a new book, Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Susan, thanks and Happy New Year.
Thank you so much. And you too.
Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. As we prepared today's show, all the talk of change and self-improvement put me in mind of a conversation I had about 6 months ago with Jon Kabat-Zinn. For those already familiar with the practice of mindfulness, Jon Kabat-Zinn needs no introduction. He is literally the inventor of mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, and he's been teaching mindfulness meditation for 4 decades. Here are some of the highlights from our interview last May. How much has what you teach in mindfulness-based stress reduction changed in 40 years?
That's a really interesting question, and I guess I'll give you a kind of a Zen, non-dual answer. Not at all, and enormously. Okay? Not at all in the sense that it's the same thing. It always is. It's like attention and awareness, and attention brought to everything in one's life in an open-hearted, spacious way. And the awareness that arises from that. On the other hand, you can't marinate in that kind of practice on a regular daily basis through formal meditation practice and bringing it into your daily life for 40 years without it changing you in certain ways. So,
well, and that's the whole point.
Well, in a way it is, or to actually not so much change you, but to allow you to actually be comfortable in your own skin, no matter what's going on in your life. And that would mean at times very stressful. Pain conditions, illness, I mean, everything that arises as part of the human condition, how to be in wiser relationship with that so that we're not, in some sense, crushed by the eventuality of things that come our way as we grow older, as we lives get more complicated, as things speed up and so forth. So I think that mindfulness has reached a point, and let me also say this is a formal meditation practice. It's not just some concept or philosophy or good idea or catechism. It's like exercising a muscle. You have to actually exercise it in order for it to develop. So mindfulness, let's be very clear, the more popular it gets, the less people understand. It's only the hardest thing in the world for us human beings to be mindful for even one moment, never mind stringing two moments of presence together in an open-hearted, spacious way. We have this capacity. What people don't understand is it's not a special state you try to achieve, like now I'm going to strive to get into some mindful state. It's like, no, mindfulness is like you're in some sense what the neuroscientists would call your default mode if you really have cultivated it, and that is open-hearted, spacious presence that understands, that knows in ways that go way beyond the mere conceptual, as I said. And so that's something that over time transforms how you are in relationship to everything. So you're the same old person you always were, and at the same time, every moment is new, fresh, different, and allows you to be, in some sense, I think, much more in touch with your multiple intelligences, and I underscore multiple, and also your own unique beauty as a human being. And rather than get lost in anxiety and depression and always trying to get through this moment so you get to some better moment on the weekend or when your kids grow up and get out of the house or whatever
guilty
it is.
Guilty as charged often.
But to realize that it never actually gets any more magical than this, because this is the only moment we ever have. And if we can't be in wise relationship to this one, and in our body and with our breath and with our thoughts, deranged as they sometimes are, and our emotions, which are turbulent as they sometimes are, if we can't be in wise relationship to that now, what makes us think that 20 years later it will be any better than that? We'll be just sort of more frenetic in some sense, maybe feel like we're more like a victim or a prisoner of what happened to us. And so you'll just be older. You won't necessarily be any wiser or more, you know, in touch with things. So this is a practice that has wisdom built into this very moment. It's saying you're already whole, which is the root meaning of the word health, healing, and holy. So if you can make that real in this moment, which is a meaning of the word realization, if you can realize that right now in the body, and we're doing it just as we're talking. People might think, well, when do we get down to the real meditation? Talking in this way, having a conversation this way, is as much meditation as anything else, because when it comes right down to it, the real meditation practice, the real mindfulness practice, is living life in the only moment we ever have.
I was going to ask you to perhaps give us some sort of exercise or a taste of how you would practice it. Is there a way to do that in, I mean, you know, we're not going to spend the next hour meditating.
Well, we might be, only you'd have to rotate your ideas about what meditation are. In fact, we will be, I'm thinking, spending the next hour meditating in the sense that, you know, your job is to put stuff out through the airwaves and people are listening to it. And hopefully, you know, if it's interesting, as your program always is, and I listen to it a lot, it sets up resonances in one's own being, in one's own mind, but also in one's own heart and in one's own body, because meaning does that. And it shows us things that we don't already know. So if we're truly listening to the radio, to this program, or to anybody, or even to the waves coming in at the shore, if we're truly listening, that's a moment of mindful presence. So we could easily spend the entire time that we have together meditating if you understand mindfulness as simply being appropriately present to what's unfolding in this moment. So that said, I'm aware that a lot of your listeners are probably in the car driving around and so already splitting their attention. So rather than doing things, you know, like ringing bells. And
we're not going to have everybody stop and sit and close their eyes.
No, exactly. Pull over to the side of the road and test this out. It occurred to me that driving itself is a form of mindfulness, or hopefully it's a form of mindfulness. There are far too many automobile accidents. But, you know, when you are really not just staring through the windshield, but actually apprehending what's coming in front of you through your windshield and also aware of the side mirrors and the rear view mirror in a certain way, you are in the present moment. And then something comes up, like you see something, maybe it's a tow truck, maybe it's a cow, and your attention gets captured and you want to follow the tow truck, but you're going 60 or 70 miles an hour. You can't afford to turn your head and follow the cow or the tow truck.
That actually seems like
you
a great metaphor.
You have to bring your attention back to what's right in front of the windshield.
And that seems like a great metaphor, actually, for modern day life, that we're all going at 60 or 70 miles an hour all the time.
Very true.
And we can't get distracted. We have to keep our focus on
very
on
true.
What's
and
right
you
in
know,
the
but when you do that, you discover that the now also has a timeless quality to it. So you might be looking at your watch and saying, I'm already late. I got to get there. And you start putting your foot on the gas and so forth. But you're not late. You're here, wherever that is. You're exactly where you are now. And when you get to where you're going, then you'll be there. And you could call it late. But the fact is, it's not going to help if you speed up and, you know, kill somebody or have an accident or something like that, because your concept of late makes you a little bit crazy or stressed.
How is mindfulness different from relaxation?
Okay. I like to say that mindfulness is not relaxation spelled differently. For one thing, relaxation is a kind of state of mind and body that when you're experiencing it, you feel completely at home and relaxed, okay? And when you don't experience it, you think you've failed in some way. If you're trying to do a relaxation exercise and you're not relaxed at the end, you'll feel, oh, either there's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with the exercise or there's something wrong with the person who is leading the exercise.
So, in fact, feeling stressed could be part of mindfulness?
You got it. Yeah. It's like I say to people often in, that we're going to teach you how to be so relaxed it's okay to be tense. Can you feel what that does? It expands the number of dimensions with which we have to work that allow us to be in wise relationship with the fact that this might be a very stressful, time-pressured moment. And if you're in the sort of media business, of course, you have lots of stressful, time-pressured moments. But how you are in relationship to them, there you have a lot of freedom. You have a lot of control. So you can be relaxed in situations, and in fact, you need to, in some cases, be extremely relaxed in cases where it's even life and death. And so these are kinds of mindfulness is much more than relaxation, but than what people commonly think of as relaxation. And again, if you come back to just pure awareness, you're as close as you can get through the thought mechanism, and the rest, you have to exercise the muscle.
And studies have shown that meditation, mindfulness, really does produce both structural and functional changes in the brain. Can you describe some of those changes?
Yeah, this is a new field in science known as neuroplasticity. When I was a graduate student, it didn't exist. The notion that the brain is actually an organ of experience. It's the most complex arrangement of matter in the known universe, with 200 billion neurons, another 200 billion glial cells in there that nobody really knows what they're doing, but they're not there by accident. I mean, this is like right inside our little old heads, you know, an infinite number of trillions of synaptic connections, and they are continually changing on the basis of our experience. And actually, the structure of the brain has been shown to change and is often driven by repetitive experience. So learning involves neuroplastic changes, development of new neurons, new synaptic connections, and so forth. So now there's this technology, including functional magnetic resonance imaging and so forth, that allows us to look at things like what's called functional connectivity, how the actual connections are changing, stabilizing, fortifying themselves over the course of a period of time or even short periods of time meditating. Sarah Lazar and her group at the Mass General Hospital have shown that meditators tend to have thicker brains in certain regions. What's called gray matter density is increased in certain regions that have to do with, like, the hippocampus. Learning and memory is one of the major functions, emotion regulation. The cerebellum, a temporal parietal junction. So these are all domains of the brain that have different functions. We think we know what some of them are. Some of them have to do with perspective taking. And then there's the prefrontal cortex, the whole frontal cortical area that's involved in working memory capacity and what's called executive functioning. And so some of the changes that we see are thickening of different regions of the brain that have to do with this kind of perspective taking, navigating the complexities of life and so forth, emotional regulation, attention regulation. Also, the amygdala, which is in the threat reaction center in the centers in the brain, they get thinner with 8 weeks of MBSR. And this is, again, the work from...
So does that... I mean, it sounds like Lazar's thicker brain would be better. So we're doing
yeah,
more
and
of the regulating, more decision-making,
long-term,
and less threat reaction.
Exactly. And long-term meditators, there's less decline in the brain over age, it seems. Now, this entire science is in its infancy. So I don't want to give you the impression we know everything about this most complex domain in the universe inside our own heads. But we're beginning to get increasing evidence that meditation practice, especially if you do it on a regular basis, is really, really good for the brain. It also turns out that another science that wasn't known 30 years ago is the field of epigenetics. It's not just the brain that's a dynamical, continually changing element of our lives and bodies, but also our genome, our chromosomes, are continually upregulating and downregulating various genes different in different cells. And then when we start to study this, it turns out that that we see what are called the epigenetic changes in genes that seem to be related to inflammation and to cancer, what are called proto-oncogenes. And these are downregulated in many studies of people who are practicing mindfulness. So those are two regions. The third one, everybody will be interested because it has to do with aging. You know, so people have probably heard about telomeres, which are these repeat subunits of DNA at the ends of our chromosomes. And it turns out that they degrade every time the cell divides, and they degrade faster when we're under chronic stress. So if you've ever had the thought cross your mind, wow, that experience took years off my life.
Yeah,
it's probably
true. I constantly say to my kids, you're aging me faster.
Exactly.
You're giving me gray hairs.
There's a certain way in which that's actually molecularly true. But the good news is that when you cultivate exercise these muscles that we're talking about with mindfulness, then actually an enzyme called telomerase rebuilds the telomeres so that they don't degrade as fast. In other words, you're slowing down the molecular cellular aging process and even maybe lengthening it. So again, I want to emphasize all of this is in its infancy, but the level of high quality research coming out of lots and lots of neuroscience labs and clinical labs all over the country and all over the world is staggering. And so that's, I think, one of the driving factors in getting people interested in this, because the new, in some sense, religion, unfortunately, is science. So people say, well, if science shows this is valuable, then... But that, too, can be hyped. So I think we have to proceed with a certain degree of caution and say, this is very, very promising. But as I say in the beginning of the revised edition of Full Catastrophe Living, which is the book I wrote on mindfulness-based stress reduction, I say right out there, close to the first page, that if there were no science of mindfulness, I'd still be practicing it. Because it gives such remarkable benefits to the quality of life that we live from moment to moment and how it affects our mental health, our emotional health, our physical health, and our sense of deep interconnectedness with the rest of the world, with other people and the planet, that even if there was no science of like the amygdala shrinks and the hippocampus gets thicker and so forth, I'd still be practicing because there's a certain way in which we know that inwardly, and that inner satisfaction is much more important than putting up a before and after brain scan of your experience of MBSR, so to speak.
That was Jon Kabat-Zinn from our conversation in May of 2016. You can find that whole interview, including some tips for getting started with a mindfulness practice, on our website, capeandislands.org. Happy New Year to all of you. Good luck with your New Year's resolutions. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.